And welcome into the Friday edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. A ton of news to get to from the week. No bigger story than the Wisconsin Badgers being ground zero for COVID-19 in college football. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Also, 6 decades ago, Tony La Russa was named the manager of the Chicago White Sox in 1979. So 70s, 80s, 90s, aughts, teens, and now 2021. Tony La Russa is back. Couple of mind-numbing factoids about La Russa then versus La Russa now. We'll get to that. And, of course, the Packers are back home getting ready to take on the Minnesota Vikings on Sunday before their short turnaround to San Francisco to play the 49ers, which, as we all know, went so well when they did that a year ago, both times in the regular season and then, of course, in the NFC Championship game. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Twitter and Instagram, at Doug Russell Pod. You can search for the Doug Russell Podcast on Facebook. Our email is DougRussellPod@gmail.com. We've now, by the way, been doing this for over a month, and I've been blown away by the early response. We've been downloaded in more than 20 states, which is awesome, mostly in Wisconsin, of course, as one might suspect. But we've also been downloaded on 4 continents, North America, Australia, Europe, and Asia. So 4 down, 3 to go. If we can knock out Antarctica, then you know we're cooking with grease. Thursday night, spent 2 hours on the air with Bill Michaels and Mike Clemens talking some Packers football. That was on the statewide Bill Michaels Sports Network in Milwaukee on 1250 WSSP, but on 15 other stations around the state as well. I'll bring you a portion of that conversation coming up a little bit later on in the show. Leading off, this is a surprise to no one who's been paying attention, but there were some breathless tweets and some stories. Oh, I can't believe that if you've been paying attention, you knew this was coming, but the Brewers declined their $15 million option on Ryan Braun on Thursday. He is officially a free agent. He can do one of 3 things. Number one, he can sign with the Brewers for less money than the $15 million he would have gotten. Don't forget, they're still paying him his $4 million buyout, so it's not like he walks away completely empty-handed, but that's one option. He can re-sign with the Brewers for less money. There's another option to sign with another club. I could only see him signing with either the Dodgers or maybe the Angels if he wants to be a designated hitter. Now, the DH not coming to the National League in 2021. That was a thought, and that might have been a path for Ryan Braun to return to the Brewers as a designated hitter or to go to the Dodgers, his hometown team, as a designated hitter. Well, there's no DH in the National League, but there is obviously still in the American League, so an outside chance that he could go to the Los Angeles Angels, but probably not. He's from Los Angeles, so that's a possibility. He could sign with another club. And then there's the third option, which I think by far is the most likely option. He could just retire. Ryan Braun's had a 14-year major league career, all with the Brewers, but he's had these debilitating, nagging injuries for the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years or so. I mean, he's killing himself just to be able to play in 60% of his team's games. His open market value is not very high right now. I mean, this is a player who once made 5 straight All-Star games. Hasn't made one, though, since 2015. Last year, hit just .233, the lowest of his career. An OPS of .769, the lowest of his career, and played in just 39 games. Obviously, it was a truncated season because of COVID, so 39 of the 60 games. But nothing is trending well for the future of Ryan Braun's career. I think he's gotten to the end of the road. I think that he's squeezed everything that he could possibly squeeze as a major league player out of his body, and the sense that I get is that he's at peace with it. So if this is it, let's take a look at his final numbers. 352 home runs, that's a Brewers record, number one all time. 1,154 RBIs, second only to Robin Yount. 1,766 games, that's fourth all time. 1,963 hits, that's third all time on the team. Just shy of 2,000, by the way. It's almost, a real shame that he couldn't get to that 2000 plateau. Lifetime 296 batting average, so that's fourth all-time in Brewers history. second in extra base hits, second in total bases, second in slugging percentage, third in stolen bases. You get the idea. Every major offensive category, Ryan Braun is in the top five. He won an MVP. He moved positions at least three times on a permanent basis, started out as a third baseman, moved to left field, then moved to right field, then moved back to left field. There was a thought that he was going to be a first baseman a couple of years ago. That never really panned out. He played a handful of games over at first base, but nothing worthy of real mention. So versatile, a good fielder, Gold Glove finalist a couple of times. Never won one. I thought he should have won one, maybe in left field, 2010, 2011, somewhere in there. He was a rancid third baseman. Just couldn't make that throw from third base over to first base. It was an adventure for the fans sitting behind first base when he first came up in 2007. But what an electric hitter. Rookie of the year in 2007. But, of course, he's got the PED scandal. And he lied about it. If it was just the PEDs and he served a suspension and turned the page on it and said, you know what, this is why I did it, because of all these nagging injuries, I wanted to stay on the field. If that would have been it, he probably could have survived it, but he lied about it. And he knows it, and he's had to have that hanging over his head for the rest of his career. He's had to have that hanging over his head since 2013. And that's what's going to keep him from being that next-level generational superstar in the eyes of many Brewers fans. You know how it is when somebody retires or somebody dies. I mean, I remember when Kobe Bryant died and there was this groundswell of support that number 24 and number 8 should be retired throughout all of the NBA, which is stupid. Nothing against Kobe, but he didn't have, as much as you want to think that he had that kind of impact, he did not have that kind of impact. What you're doing is you're equating what Kobe Bryant did to what Jackie Robinson did. That's the bar that's been set. Wayne Gretzky was the greatest hockey player in history. And there was a thought that, well, they should retire number 99, and that's what the NHL did. And it was stupid. Jackie Robinson is the bar. There's a thought around Major League Baseball to retire number 21 for Roberto Clemente. I'll entertain that because it goes beyond what the athlete did on the field of play. There's a thought that number 23 should be retired throughout the NBA for Michael Jordan. No, no, it shouldn't. It should be retired by the Chicago Bulls and no one else, even though the Miami Heat already did it. Where am I going with this? There's a thought, and when Ryan Braun, it was revealed that this might be it, or, you know, on Thursday when it was revealed that the Brewers did indeed decline his option. Well, the Brewers should absolutely retire number 8. Probably not. It's probably not going to get retired. You look at the litmus test that the Brewers have already set forth as far as what constitutes a number being retired. Number one, you got to be in the Hall of Fame. Number two, you have to have had a significant impact on the Brewers. Well, he's got one, but he doesn't have the other. He's not going to go to the Hall of Fame. You look at the numbers that the Brewers have already retired. Number four, Paul Molitor, Hall of Famer. Number 19, Robin Yount, spent his entire career with the Brewers, Hall of Famer. Number 34, Raleigh Fingers, Hall of Famer, won an MVP and a Cy Young Award with the Brewers, their first playoff team. I question whether or not Raleigh Fingers should have his number retired, but they went ahead and retired it. And Hank Aaron. Now, Hank Aaron is certainly a different category in terms of his meaning to the Brewers versus his meaning to Milwaukee baseball. You look outside Miller Park, there's a statue of Hank Aaron, but he's in a Braves uniform. And I think that's okay. The impact that Hank Aaron had on Milwaukee baseball warrants a statue outside of Miller Park. That's the same thing that I've said about Warren Spahn. What Warren Spahn did for the city of Milwaukee and its baseball history warrants a statue outside of Miller Park, even though it would be in a Milwaukee Braves uniform and not a Milwaukee Brewers uniform. Hank Aaron played for the Brewers, but he sucked when he was with the Brewers. No offense. I love Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron is my all-time, he's my guy. But when he was with the Brewers, he was at the tail end of his career and he wasn't very good. He was brought in for one reason and one reason only, and that's to put fannies in the seats at County Stadium. That's okay. That's fine. But don't kid yourself as to why number 44 is hanging up at Miller Park. It had nothing to do with what he did for the Milwaukee Brewers, but what he did for Milwaukee baseball. Ryan Braun doesn't rise to that level. At one point, we thought that he might rise to that level, but he did not rise to that level. He'll absolutely get a Wall of Honor plaque. He'll probably get a spot on the Walk of Fame at Miller Park. I'm a voter for that, by the way, so I'll always vote for Ryan Braun for that. He'll get a day in his honor, but I think that's about it. He's not going to get his number retired. He's certainly not going to get a statue outside of Miller Park. But I do think that his career is over. And it was a great career for the Brewers, 14 seasons and some of the most clutch hits in Brewers history. All right, moving along. It is the biggest story in the world right now, and it hits close to home this week for the Wisconsin Badgers football team. They've been hit hard by coronavirus. Saturday's game at Nebraska has been canceled. This from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Jeff Patrikas. Three more members of the Wisconsin football program, two staff members and one player have tested positive for coronavirus. UW officials released those numbers Thursday afternoon. That brings the total of current cases to 16. That's eight players and eight staff members. According to UW, 15 of the positive tests have come since Saturday, the day after UW opened the season with a 45-7 victory over Illinois. The Badgers football program tweeted this out yesterday as well, October 29th. Three additional confirmed positive cases, so that's a total of 16 active cases, as Jeff Patrikas wrote. The earliest possible return is November 4th because they had to hit pause on everything. So next Tuesday, next Wednesday, they can resume football activities. And the earliest possible return for Coach Paul Christ, who came down with COVID-19, is November 7th. So late Wednesday afternoon, Athletic Director Barry Alvarez and the coach Paul Christ met the media. First up, Alvarez. He was asked about the internal decision to not play this weekend at Nebraska.
The game was canceled. It got to the point where it was orange-red. But let's take a look at the timeline. Our first month of testing and practice, we had one positive. We had one positive test, I believe it was Wednesday prior to the game. Since the game, we've had 12 positive tests. We just felt with the number of positives and that short a timeline, the chancellor and I felt we have an issue that we had to make this decision and get our arms around this and control the COVID and the virus now before it got out of hand.
Go to Jim Polzine.
Barry, this 7-day pause would seem to put the week three game against Purdue in jeopardy. How worried are you about that and what needs to happen, before then to make sure you guys can play that game or any other games going forward?
Yeah, we'll see where we are as far as testing and we'll make that decision as we move closer to the game. But the most important thing right now is to quarantine our players and get this under control. We'll make that decision about playing the next game when that time comes.
Go to Steve McGargy.
Thank you for doing this. I think you answered my first question. The release had said six players, six staff members, but tests were pending. I'm just checking to make sure there haven't been any more since then. And also, what do you think might have just kind of caused this outbreak? Was it just the statewide numbers just kind of catching up to y'all, or what do you think might have caused this?
Yeah, Steve, that's hard to answer why. I don't have an answer for that. We do have a couple that are still pending.
Go to Adam Rittenberg.
Barry, from what you know about the testing, was this always a possibility? I mean, we heard things about how this would limit contact tracing and ideally limit the number of positive tests in a short period. Some people are wondering, did the testing not work right? Or was this always a possibility in your mind from what you knew about the antigen testing every day?
Adam, we felt like the daily quick response test would answer contact tracing for us. Obviously it's not the total answer, but it is given us some criteria that we can go on. And, you know, we felt after the first month that we had pretty good grasp of it and we're confident in it.
Go to Heather Dinich.
Barry, can you hear me okay?
Yes, Heather.
So just two follow-ups on logistics. When you talked about the orange-red, does that mean that you had to follow Big Ten protocol to make this decision? Is the first question. Can you clarify that?
Yes. The decision fell into the category where the chancellor and I would make the decision, had the prerogative to make a decision. And with 12 since the game, we felt it was appropriate to make the decision not to play.
As for Coach Paul Christ, he's in isolation after testing positive. So that begs the question as to how long he'll be out.
It's 10 days for coaches and 21 for players. And, you know, I was in on Coach Alvarez's call as well. And I think that's one of the questions came up is, you know, with our medical staff. And I think that's where for the players that have it, it is 10 days of really not doing a lot. And I think that's where you've got the built-in time for the players. And that's why it's a different number for the players. And, you know, with the myocarditis and the number of tests that they're doing and the checkups, that's why they're two different. As far as I don't know, Colton, today or right now, as we said that when does the clock start, right? And obviously we'll find that out.
Go to Jeff Patricus.
Paul, quick two-parter. One, first of all, how do you feel physically? And then second, you talked at length and your players have about how to mitigate this, to do all the right things. But there were times it looked like during the game where the facial covering was below your nose, which they don't recommend. Do you look back now at some things where the team or you missed some opportunities to be tighter and with the way you handled things?
Yeah. First part of your question is, you know, I physically feel good. Certainly disappointed, right, for the, you know, for what's happened. And, you know, throughout this whole, really kind of as we've gone about this, you know, we were wanting the opportunity and our players were wanting the opportunity to play. And then to not have that opportunity. And I know why, and I support, you know, and understand why we're not. But, you know, when you have a hand in it, you don't feel that that's where there's a disappointment. As far as are there things that personally or even team-wise that, you know, you go through it with everything, you know, certainly it was before today. You know, I mean, I was what you're mentioning about the mask, you know, and I kind of, you know, gone through practice and it was good. And then I didn't know if it was because of the daylight and then it was fogging up. And so that was something I needed to get better at. Right. And was working on that, you know, yesterday on the field, you know, I had the shield and the mask. And, you know, see, there are always things, you know, it was also, I think, asked in kind of Barry's portion of the of this, you know, what have we done? Were there things that we did differently? Or that, you know, I think every day you're trying to look at what is it that we can do to try to be doing this better, right? And to mitigate it. And certainly, you know, this is, and I don't profess to be an expert on this, but this is one part of this virus that it gets you in a number of different ways. And, you know, if you get, we don't know, like, did we have one super spreader? Did we, you know, I don't know that, Jeff, right? But you're absolutely always going to look at how can we be better and what do we need to do? And you know, we changed stuff really at the start of, you know, the end of last week. And, you know, even when we went, you know, I know it was brought up before and kind of at the hotel and we, you know, we didn't have any team meals. We didn't, we had it available and there was to-goes and then you could kind of had some spaced out seating for some, you know, it was 10 in a room and big rooms. And so you try to do all you can and it, you know, do I know that something there caused it? You know, I don't know ground zero or where it really started. And that's where you continue to try to, you know, it's what we, right, the big thing is in any of this is what's our response. And the response is absolutely try to find every way that you can, one, how do we lower the curve, right? And that's what this, the 7 day pause is. And to not have as many, it was, you know, we had a number of positives. And so you, first thing is to try to lower that. And then it's, you know, as you go forward, what are the different things we can do to allow ourselves to give us a chance to play. And that's something that will be, you do every day, I think.
Obviously the Badgers game against Purdue is in jeopardy. The whole season has always been in jeopardy though, as 16 active cases. That's nothing short of a full on outbreak. All right, we've got a Packers preview coming up, but this is the craziest story in sports by far this week. Tony La Russa is back managing the Chicago White Sox. Now, Tony La Russa first managed the White Sox in 1979. There's a couple of really wild statistics coming up here in a second, but let's go back to 1979 for a second. Jimmy Carter was president. The biggest TV shows on were MASH, Three's Company, and The Jeffersons.
Come and knock on our door.
Come and knock on our door.
We've been waiting for you.
Polyester, of course, was in. A postage stamp. Does anybody, I mean, I know that mail-in balloting is, well, by now, if you still have your ballot and you have any thoughts of mailing it in, don't. Just drive it in because, the you know, don't count on the Postal Service to get it there on time. But a postage stamp, what is it? Is it 55 cents? I don't even know what it is right now. It was 15 cents. 15 cents in 1979. And this was big for when I was a kid. The Walkman was introduced. You know what a Walkman? I don't know. What's a Walkman, Dad? A Walkman was a little tiny cassette player that you could put, you know, a cassette tape in and listen to music. And, you know, the really advanced ones also had radios. So you could either listen to the radio or you could listen to your music wherever you went. It was really the first portable music player. I mean, everybody's got them on their phones now. The technology is, night and day doesn't even do justice to it. I mean, different planets of technology from 1979 to 2020. But the Walkman was introduced and it cost $200 just to be able to take your music with you. A cassette tape. $200. So that was 1979. But here are two crazy statistics. One of them I researched on my own. Another I completely got wrong and had to do a mea culpa on. But it's a stat that I think is, it's just crazy when you think about it. Here's the first statistic. Tony La Russa has outlived five of the players that he managed on his first White Sox team. There are five of his players that have died in the time that Tony La Russa first managed the White Sox to today on that 1979 team. The second crazy statistic, and one that I was incredulous about, this couldn't possibly be, and yet, apparently it is. Ryan Spader, who I'm not familiar with, a baseball statistician, maybe I should be more familiar with him. I apologize for not being more familiar with him because I should have just taken him at his word, because this is me publicly mea culping. I already did it on Twitter, but I'll do it again. Ryan wrote on Twitter, Tony La Russa has managed 2.3% of all games in MLB history. That can't be. That can't be. 2.3% of all games in Major League history have been managed by Tony La Russa. So, not checking the math, like I probably should have, I tweeted back out to Ryan Spader, that is flat out wildly, wildly in all caps, that is flat out wildly incorrect. Please check your math. And he did. And he was very polite about it. He, you know, listen, you say something wrong on Twitter, the Twitter trolls come out and just blast you. Like they think I care about being, oh, you're being ratioed down. Whatever. I'm much more concerned about Ryan and his gracious response to my jackassery than anything else. So Ryan writes back, Doug, hello. He managed 5,097 games since 1871. There have been 221,495 games 2.30%. And since 1876, there have been 220,409 games, which is 2.31%. I went to one decimal place to appease both the pro and anti-National Association crowds. Wildly correct. Hope this helps. He's right. The math checks. So that was a gracious response to my, again, my jackassery. So thank you, Ryan, for correcting me. I'm 100%. That is the craziest statistic ever. When you think about the fact that one manager has managed more than 2% of all Major League Baseball games. Connie Mack has been dead. And Ryan wrote this back as well. Connie Mack has been dead for 67 years, and he's managed over 3% of all Major League games, which is nuts when you think about all the games that have been played in Major League history. That is the, I mean, in all of baseball, to me, that's the single craziest statistic. But Tony La Russa, at age 76, is back. So that begs the question, why?
I think all managers would understand this. I think everybody would understand this. How rare it is to get an opportunity to manage a team that's this talented and this close to winning. Most of the time, your chances are the opposite. So the combination of looking forward to getting back down there and checking myself, you know, to have the energy and all that stuff, and the White Sox making the call with a chance to win sooner rather than later. I'm excited that they made that choice and looking forward to what's ahead.
White Sox general manager Rick Hahn is convinced that La Russa is the right man for the job.
In the end, Tony was the choice because it's believed that Tony is the best man to take us in the to win, help us win championships over the next several years and usher us into what we expect to be a very exciting phase for White Sox baseball.
Now, the White Sox have a good team, and that division is perpetually wide open, so there's a real chance there, but we'll see how La Russa's style plays a decade after he last managed. How is he going to relate to younger players? I guess we're going to find out coming up next year. On to the Packers. They're back home against the Vikings on Sunday with some nagging injuries starting to pop up, including one with kicker Mason Crosby, coach Matt LaFleur.
That's something that we have a plan for in case Mason can't go. I know the personnel department, we always have somebody kind of like waiting in the wings, so to speak, just in case something were to occur. Because, you know, just with the requirements with the COVID situation, you can't make those quick transactions. So we always have people rolling through each week, and we have a plan for that.
Also, cornerback Kevin King had a setback this week.
Yeah, there was, unfortunately, because he is such a good football player, and I love his approach, and I know he's doing everything in his power to get back as quickly as possible, but sometimes those things happen, and it's unfortunate, but that's what happened.
Now, the Packers will have two games in 4 days as they get the dreaded Thursday night football game at San Francisco, no less, after they're done with Minnesota. One of LaFleur's jobs is to make sure that his guys don't look past the 1-5 Vikings.
Listen, this is a good football team. I don't care what the record says. All you got to do is look at the last couple of performances, Tennessee Titans and Seattle. I mean, two games that they had. So if we look any further than that, we're going to be in trouble.
Meanwhile, of course, there is still the specter of COVID. There have been outbreaks in the NFL, but Wisconsin, specifically in the Fox Valley, that's been a hot spot. It's something that hasn't faded in focus, though, so far in Green Bay.
I think it's something that we continue to bring up and just make everybody aware of kind of the circumstances amongst other teams, amongst ourselves, and just making sure that we're doing the best job that we possibly can. I think some of that stuff's out of your control a little bit, but it is our responsibility to this football team to try to do everything in our own power to be vigilant and make sure we're trying to stay as healthy as possible.
Now, the Vikings, of course, come in at just 1-5. Their experiment in regards to Kirk Cousins appears to be a giant flop. But as Aaron Rodgers noted during his Wednesday media availability, they do have a coach who has had success.
Every time you play a Mike Zimmer team, you got to be ready for everything. He's a phenomenal coach. To see him mentioned being on the hot seat to me is absolutely crazy. I think he's one of the best coaches in the league and has been for a long time. You know, it's just, they don't all give you the trouble and the scheme that Mike does. I have a lot of respect for the way that he coaches and the way he especially coaches defense.
Now, there are two big items coming up on the calendar next Tuesday, the election, of course, and the NFL trading deadline. We know Aaron is engaged in the political process, but how engaged will he be in what goes on around the league?
Obviously, I did not hear. You guys are talking about it. We got the network on, and we got that other channel on all the time in the cafeteria. So looking at it, you're hearing it. Guys are talking about it, but see it when we see it.
As for the game on Sunday, Rodgers has great respect for the Minnesota defense.
Harrison's always been one of the best disguising safeties in the league. When they have all their veterans playing over the years, it's been really, really difficult. I see them doing some more of that the last few weeks and really trying to disguise things, especially on third down that Mike has made a living for so many years. But, 22 is always a guy you have to figure out where he's at, because he has been for a lot of years a really, really good blitzer as well as a good cover guy.
This game, of course, a rematch of opening weekend when the star of the game was Davante Adams. Davante catching 14 passes for 156 yards and 2 touchdowns in week one.
It wasn't like we came in on that Wednesday or Monday or Tuesday and said, we're going to throw Davante 15 targets, just like it wasn't on Sunday either. It was more just a product of, our third downs with a lot of man coverage. He had the opportunities. He had some one-on-ones and he made some great plays.
This time around, though, for Davante, it's all about preparation.
You want to attack it as if they're the same Minnesota that they've been for the past few years. Obviously, they're not where they want to be based off the wins and, how they've done this year, but it's still a really good team. You look at them on paper and you look at some of the playmakers that they have, whether it be offense or defense, they got a really good, solid team still, so you can't disrespect it. You got to go out there and treat them just like they were when they're at the top of their game.
Thursday night on the statewide Bill Michaels Sports Network, I had a chance to join Bill and Mike Clements for a 2-hour wide-ranging discussion of all things Packers. Here's a portion of that.
They had Seattle. They lost to them by 1 point, and in my opinion, should have won the game. Same with the Tennessee Titans. They lost to them by 1 point. Those are two teams that have lost one game apiece. So if you don't get ready to play each and every week in this league, you're going to get whipped.
There you go. Those are the words of Matt LaFleur talking about the Vikings' schedule so far. One thing about this game that bothers me is, and what I said going into the last break, was there's two words that I think that could possibly derail this Packers team, and people are using it quite frequently this week, is trap game, because you've got a quick turnaround. You're looking ahead to the game that is supposed to be the litmus test by which you are going to either be judged and or redeem yourself from that Tampa Bay game, and that's San Francisco on Thursday night. So, Mike, I'll start with you this time. This game, I don't think the Packers are overlooking the Minnesota Vikings, a divisional rival. But coming in at 1-5 and you being at 5-1, and knowing that San Francisco's on the docket and who's going to be playing, what injured player is going to be saved for the San Francisco game versus this game, it's one of those things that you got to put into the psyche a little bit, right?
LaFleur was asked this today about, you got that 49ers game next week. That's a big game. Are you taking a peek at that? Of course, he laughed at it. He's like, we have one game to play. That's Sunday at noon against the Minnesota Vikings, and there'll be no other discussion of any other football games until then. But we all know around about 6 or 7 o'clock Saturday night, if not early Saturday morning, they're going to start looking at San Francisco,
Right.
And they'll be paying attention to what San Francisco does on the late game on Sunday afternoon when they've got to go up to Seattle and play the Seahawks. I mean, that's going to be a battle royale in the division. So, really, it's the four-hour flight out there for Green Bay. But I'd rather be playing the Vikings at home in 40-mile-an-hour wind on Sunday than probably being the 49ers and, a bloodbath against Pete Carroll and those Seahawks in your division.
Doug, I don't look at this game just because it's the rival is a trap game, but I think there is some juggling going on when it comes to the use of certain players that may be injured. Could a guy like, say, Aaron Jones come back in this game? But you don't want these guys banged up coming off of injury and then trying to recuperate on a quick turnaround. So that might play into the decision as to whether or not you play guys in this game, correct?
Absolutely, and I think it should, and I think that's proper, and that's why they have coaches and scouts that do that, that don't get into the psyche of the players about those things. I mean, Matt LaFleur is 8-0 in the NFC North, as we were talking about earlier, Bill, for a reason. I mean, he knows how important these games are. He's imparted that upon his team. The record reflects that. San Francisco could be a very, very difficult game for them. I think that's the folly of Thursday night football. I love football as much as the next guy, but when you're asking these guys to play a game on Sunday and then just 3 days later fly two time zones away and try to play in prime time, you have to be thinking about, you mentioned one of them, Aaron Jones is probably someone who should be held out of Sunday's game against Minnesota. David Bakhtiari, especially with the job that Billy Turner did over at left tackle this past week against Houston, you've got to really and by the way, Houston, their record is lousy and the defense is atrocious, but the one thing that they do well and have done well the entire season, Sunday's game notwithstanding, is get to the quarterback. And Billy Turner, I thought, did a really, really nice job on the offensive line on Sunday. So maybe you think about David Bakhtiari and maybe saving some powder on him for the Thursday night game against San Francisco as well. Absolutely, you have to think about that game coming up. I don't necessarily think that it comes at the expense of the Minnesota game per se, because Minnesota is down and it looks like they're, I don't like the word tanking, but it doesn't appear as though they're putting their best foot forward right now. We'll put it that way, as they try to, position themselves for Trevor Lawrence, as we were talking about earlier. But does it play a part in the way that the Packers are going to use their personnel this coming Sunday against Minnesota? Absolutely. And it should.
It's a good point, Doug, too, because the Texans, too. I mean, they had Merciless out there, J.J. Watt. That touchdown pass from Aaron Rodgers to Robert Tonyan, and by the way, that's how he's pronouncing his last name now. Tonyan.
Correct.
Tonyan. Did you guys see that? Correct. Yeah.
I did.
Think of Funyan, yeah. Bobby Tonyan, Robert Tonyan. Anyway, I mean, what a beautiful play. I mean, it looked like J.J. Watt was going to kill Aaron Rodgers. And instead, Rodgers knew he was coming, knew where the pressure was coming off from the right-hand side, and made a perfect little teardrop pass that dropped into Tonyan for a touchdown, kind of like a screen. I mean, that's what Aaron Rodgers brings to the table. But I think he only got hit, you're right, Doug, like one sack. He got hit a couple of times, but that makeshift offensive line did a pretty darn good job on the road in Houston.
Now that we've got Ngakoue gone, like you had mentioned, Mike, Barr, Hunter, both done for the remainder of the season, this defensive front is nowhere near as lethal as they once were. So, I mean, look, anything can happen, I agree, but I don't have the same amount, same level of worry as I did maybe coming into the beginning of the season. So when you analyzed Billy Turner and you looked at the film, Billy Turner, he kept the pocket. He didn't get bull rushed. He didn't get pushed around. There was maybe once where he really was kind of, diving and hanging on to his guy. But when you look at this film, guys, and again, I'll go back to Mike real quick. Did you see anything that would tell you that Billy Turner could not be a left tackle? And the reason I ask is because looking at all the speculation was, well, now does that put, the worst thing that could have happened to David Bakhtiari in his career with the Green Bay Packers is the fact that his contract is coming up and they found somebody else that can take his space. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true?
I think they're thinking about it. I think they're looking at it. And I asked Adam Stenovich a couple of weeks ago, the offensive line coach. To me, I thought the plan was let Bulaga go. Oh, by the way, he's now missed a couple of games with the Chargers with back injuries. That would have happened here probably in Green Bay. And so it was just continue with Billy Turner at right guard and then bring in this Rick Wagner guy, 8 years, to hold on right tackle. And with these younger guys, you've got some backup, and away you go. But Wagner seemed to be slow to pick up the offense, had an elbow injury in camp. And so then Billy has to take all these snaps at right tackle. Lane Taylor wins the job. Lane goes down in that game against these Vikings on that synthetic turf, trying to zip outside, gets his knee all turned around. And so Lucas Patrick has to go up. And so at the end of the day, I'm thinking, wow, look at, because of all this, and Billy Turner had some injuries at the start of the season as well. It wasn't this the blueprint, is that Turner would be a guard? And Stenovich said, I thought he should have been playing tackle last year. He's more of a natural tackle than he is a guard. And the guys who break down the All-22 film said, he's fine in as a run blocker at guard. He was not good. He just, for some reason, was not very good at the pass protection at right guard, much better at outside there at tackle. And I found that to be really interesting. So his position coach, thinks he's a tackle, not a guard. And so they need to bring up more of these backups at guards and get him on the outside.
Doug, the last time these two teams met, Devontae Adams, 17 targets, 14 catches, 156 yards. You've got rookies back there trying to defend this guy, and they're a little more experienced now, but he's also healthy. He's feeling good, and he's coming off of a really big game. Is there any stopping? Because the only way I see the Vikings beating the Packers is if they're able to stop Devontae Adams. Is there any stopping Devontae Adams?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be Cameron Dantzler who's going to do it. I don't think it's going to be Holton Hill that's going to be holding down Devontae Adams at this point.
You don't? You don't?
I'm going to go out on a limb with those guys.
Yeah.
Look, Devontae Adams, when he's healthy, is an elite wide receiver in the NFL. The problem that, and the only thing that's kept the Packers' offense back is that they haven't had healthy bodies and productive bodies around him. We've already talked ad nauseum about the Packers' porous wide receiving core right now when Alan Lazard isn't able to play and be healthy because of all the other guys that just haven't stepped up, MVS being the most, I guess, egregious of those players. But yeah, Devontae Adams certainly had the Vikings number, and he's also hot after that record-setting game that he had against the Texans this past Sunday. If you've got Devontae Adams in your fantasy league, I suggest you start him coming up on Sunday.
Speaking of defense, Mike and Doug, let me start with you, Doug. Do you think the defense, the linebackers, Preston Smith had a good game? Do you think they're starting to turn the corner?
Man, you hope so, because we've been asking for this for a long time. The linebacking core for the first quarter poll of the season, even though the Packers were 4-0, I mean, what was the narrative? It was, well, I guess Blake Martinez wasn't the problem for the Packers. I mean, I'd heard that over and over and over again. So you kind of start to hope that they are starting to turn that corner. But the defense, especially the first couple of weeks of the season, I mean, they weren't very good, especially in crunch time. So you hope that guys like, you know, I still want to see something from Rashawn Gary more consistently. We'd all like to see Za'Darius Smith's sack numbers and Preston Smith's sack numbers go up. But I think that they're getting the job done. They're doing what they have to do to win football games. Now, granted, you know, when you go up against the Houston Texans, they're not going to put up much of a fight. And I don't know what kind of a fight that the Vikings are going to put up. And if you look at what the test of this Packers team is going to be, you're really looking at Thursday night. So maybe we'll have a better gauge a week from tonight's game as to how much of a corner that they've turned. But, you know, you look at the Packers' schedule so far this season, they haven't exactly beaten a lot of world beaters so far, although I do think that Detroit, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I think that Detroit is a little bit better than what we've seen in past years. But, they haven't been spectacular, but they've been good enough.
Mike, do you think they've turned the corner?
Well, I'll tell you what. I know that they feel good about certain positions, like linebacker. Now, Christian Kirksey, he goes down with the pec. He's running around on the field this week. Maybe he's back in a couple of weeks or so. But then in that opener against the Vikings, here comes this Chris Barnes, number 51 out of nowhere, leads the team in tackles all over the field. Now, he had to leave the game again against the Texans with his shoulder now that keeps on getting kind of jacked up. It was a play that was down in the red zone. But then they got Kamal Martin, the fifth-round pick, who really looked great in camp. Oh, my gosh, he was even more physical than Chris Barnes. In, like, his 20 snaps he got toward the end of that Texans game, they are excited about Kamal Martin and what he did in camp and what he did at the end of this Texans game. So they're breathing a sigh of relief. They feel an awful lot better, and they'll get Kirko back. I'll tell you who's on the outside looking in right now is Ty Summers. He had some snaps, and it almost looked like Deshaun Watson, after a couple of plays, was going after him. As a matter of fact, they scored a touchdown, threw a ball, you know, behind him, over him, when they got into the red zone. But all in all, I know they feel better about that position. On the defensive line, you had Kenny Clark out all those weeks with the groin injury. Now he's back in business. Tyler Lancaster, they're high on him, the smart kid out of Northwestern. He was limited in participation today. He's been dealing with a shoulder injury. Montrevious Adams seems to be coming along. Dean Lowry seems to be just a guy. For the guy that replaced Mike Daniels and got that contract at the start of training camp last year in 2019, you'd like to see a little bit more out of him. But now they add this Billy Wynn kid. Or he's not a kid. He's 31 years old. And this is so interesting, Bill and Doug, because this again shows this Matt LaFleur coaching staff. They've been all over the league. They've got all kinds of connections, and there's somehow, some way, you know Mike Pettine. You live down the street from Kenny Clark's mom. You know Christian Kirksey from the time you were in Cleveland. And this Billy Wynn, who's now going to line up a defensive line, this guy's been through a battery of injuries and talked today about trying to find a job when he didn't think he'd ever get back in the NFL?
Just from the job standpoint, you know, I'd put some feelers out there. You know, I started to look into at UCLA to see what, you know, they had available. University of California, Riverside, I know they had an assistant athletic director job that had opened up. So I was kind of starting to look into that a little bit. I was a communications degree major, but I was kind of wanting to stick with sports, but I didn't want to coach. So I was going to try to put that degree to use and, you know, go that route. And then from the horrible year standpoint from football, you know, it was 2016. I had the back issues all year, had the epidurals, you know, played the season, had the surgery, done with that. 17, you know, that was really the really bad year for me. That was my ACL, MCL, meniscus. And all these injuries all happened in preseason. So, you know, it's preseason's, it's always tough just because you work so hard and, you know, these things just kind of creep up on you. And they, I mean, this is the only occupation where you have a 100%, you know, injury rate. Like at some point in your career, you're going to get hurt. And for me, you know, it was, you know, 3 consecutive years. So, you know, we battled back from that. 18, I was a free agent all year. So, you know, that kind of messed with me mentally. Again, you know, I got to the point where it's like, okay, where's that fine line of what's next for me? You know, so I kept going, kept grinding. You know, 19 comes around, tricep, Hall of Fame game, you know, with Denver. You know, and so it's just always been a constant battle, you know, always battling demons and stuff like that. But I always reflect back on just my perseverance and my, you know, dealing with adversity. You know, everyone's going to deal with it. It's how you go about it and how you, you know, overcome those things that really define who you are as a character.
That's kind of funny, Billy. 2020 was sort of your year then with no preseason. Worked out.
Yeah, it was perfect. Yeah, I couldn't have asked for a better situation to walk into. Just being familiar with Pettine and Christian and all these guys, you know, and working with Dean and how down to earth he is, and Kenny, you know, quite a bit about Kenny. I lived down the street from his mom in Rancho Cucamonga. I'm pretty familiar with Kenny. Yeah, I mean, it was a great situation. You know, didn't have a training camp, didn't have OTAs, didn't have to worry about injuries. You know, I came in, I get to just work, grind, repeat.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks to Bill Michaels, his producer, Joe Zanzola, and my old friend Mike Clemens for a fun 2 hours on WSSP and around the state on the Bill Michaels Sports Network. I want to leave you with this. Bucks swingman Kyle Korver was at his alma mater, Creighton, this week. He was on stage. It looked like he was a featured speaker of some sort on campus. When he was asked a question about why and how the Bucks decided to not play one of their Orlando playoff bubble games during the first round of the playoffs.
My team specifically, I'm sure every team here was tuned in during the bubble, right? It was the first sporting events that had come on in months, so we're all tuned in. And during the game against the Magic, while you were in the bubble, what were the challenges that were running through your mind as you assessed the situation, like right before the game time, of deciding to boycott your team along with your teammates? Because you've had a voice for racial equality, notably from the incident in Utah with OKC. And what was your approach to kind of addressing those conversations about Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter and those hard conversations with your Bucks teammates?
Yeah, well, I mean, we'd had a lot of conversations about all this, and you know, a couple days before, Jacob Blake had been shot, and then there was a story about a young white kid running through the street, and he was shooting people. Our team was super raw, like I think a lot of people were, but just, you know, being that was where we were from, people were really feeling the story, and really feeling the pain. And so we walked into that game and, you know, we're trying to get ready for a playoff game, but we're not really there mentally. And there was a series of events that happened. One of our coaches, Darvin Ham, I'm sure he'd be fine with me telling this story, but he's got two sons that are in their 20s who live in Milwaukee, right? He's thinking about them. Darvin Ham's a big man. He played at Texas Tech. I don't know if you guys remember him, shattering the backboard. Like, big, strong guy, big, big guy. And he's in tears. And he came in and he said something like, "It's kids out on the streets." It's really emotional. And went into this little, the locker rooms were kind of weird, but there's like a little coaches thing that had been set up and like just took the whole thing down. everyone's jumped up and everyone's already on edge and everyone's already in bad headspace. And I just sat there in my chair with tears running down my face. And I'm looking at my jersey that says Black Lives Matter. And I'm just like, what are we doing? And one teammate, George Hill, decided that he wasn't going to play. And Sterling Brown on our team, who has his own case going on in Milwaukee right now, it's still open. He stopped at a Walgreens at like 1 a.m. and police pulled him over, ended up tasering him, arrested him for no reason, right? It's still, he's trying to create change in the city, and there's a whole court case going on. And he said, you know, I'm a George. And he stood up and he's like, you guys don't have to do this if you don't want to. Me and George are going to sit out tonight. And we all just sat there and we're like, we're all with you, right? We're with you. And there was like 13 minutes on the clock. Like, you know, this was happening in real time. We just kind of sat there and let the clock run out. And it's always interesting for me, like as a white man in these spaces, like what to do, right? How do I help as a white man? What do I say as a white man in this space? And you know what you do? You stand with the marginalized. And when you can, you amplify their voice and you listen to their thoughts and you listen to their ideas and then you find your way to help out. But in that moment, I'm like, yo, I'm with you. We had a conversation after that with like, we can't just not play this game and then go back to our room and play cards or video games. Like, what are we going to do at this moment now? And so we were in the locker room for a long time, and we ended up talking to the governor, the lieutenant governor, and he told us in that moment that after all the protests that have happened in Milwaukee, that the state legislature hadn't met one time to talk about any kind of change. All the protests, all the conversations, all the pain, they hadn't met one time. And we're like, guys, what are any of us doing? How do we create change? Right? So we talked to a bunch more people. We ended up talking to Jacob Blake's family. And his parents were so incredibly kind and gracious. And they held out this phone and we all kind of huddled around to hear. And they just like poured love on us, because we're in this moment, we're like, we're hearing other teams are not playing. I think some people are probably mad at us, you know. And in that moment, when we're sitting there listening to his family, his parents, we just sat there, we stood around the phone and cried. And we're like, we don't know exactly what the future holds. We're not sure exactly what our plan is going forward, but we're doing the right thing. This is the right thing. And it was an incredible moment. And then to watch the rest of the teams join us, right, across the country, it was really powerful.
The Brewers canceled their game that night as well. Bucks swingman Kyle Korver on the campus of Creighton University earlier this week. I think it's easy to tell athletes to just shut up and dribble, but they have a platform, and for the first time they're using it, because it's not the first time that they're using it, but it's the first time that they're really using it with the support of league officials and team owners. And I try to keep these shows on Monday and Friday as apolitical as possible, because sports is supposed to be our great unifier. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat, if you voted for Joe Biden, if you're voting for Donald Trump. If the Packers are playing on Sunday, we're all one. We're all rowing in the same direction. We're all Packers fans or Badgers fans or Brewers fans or Bucks fans, no matter what your political bent is. It seems as though that's getting harder and harder.
So I will leave you with this thought, just something to mull over. Because as a people, I think we're better as one than factions of many. And we have all walked different paths in life, and we're far more similar than different. And a little empathy and a little kindness goes a long way. The only thing that I could hope for, well, there's a couple of things that I could hope for from Tuesday's election. But the overall reaching thought that I have for Tuesday's election is to the side that wins, be gracious in victory. To the side that loses, be gracious in defeat. And know that at the end of the day, unless you're in one of those countries that I was talking about at the beginning of the show, I know we're on four continents right now. But if you're an American, that trumps everything. No pun intended. We're more similar than we are different. And again, a little empathy and a little kindness certainly goes a long way. I will leave you with that. That's it for this edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. As always, we would love to hear from you. Twitter and Instagram, at Doug Russell Pod. You can search for the Doug Russell Podcast on Facebook. Our email is DougRussellPod@gmail.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.